Radio Prague News.
The Czech foreign minister will meet the Chinese ambassador on Thursday. The president's chancellor is accused of trying to influence courts. And a Czech pensioner confesses to orchestrating a fake terrorist attack in order to discredit migrants. Czech foreign minister Tomáš Petříček will meet with Chinese ambassador Zhang Yanming on Thursday to discuss a dispute relating to Huawei and ZTE products, a spokesperson for the Czech foreign ministry said. Mr. Zhang had met personally with Prime Minister Andrej Babiš in December after the Czech National Bureau for Cybersecurity said the Chinese-made products posed a security threat. However, the two do not agree about what was said at the meeting. On Sunday, Mr. Babiš said that a Chinese embassy statement, seeming to suggest that the Czech leader had apologised over the matter, was nonsense and a lie. President Miloš Zeman's Chancellor Vratislav Mynář has been trying to influence decisions at key courts in the country, Respect reported on Monday. Among the courts that Mr. Mynář attempted to influence were the Constitutional and Supreme Administrative Courts, the Newsweekly said. These activities have been going on for several years and range from the president's right-hand man gathering information about important cases to telling courts how to decide, Respect alleged. Prague Castle spokesman Jiří Ovčáček reacted to the report by saying that Mr. Mynář had been speaking to the judges in order to inform them about the viewpoints of the president. The Ukrainian ambassador to Prague, Yevhen Perebinyits, has hit back at a statement by former Czech president Václav Klaus, who said on Sunday that Ukraine was being goaded by Western political elites, including that of the Czech Republic, to provoke Russia. Mr. Perebinyits asked on Twitter whether Czechoslovakia had provoked Nazi Germany to action in 1938. Mr. Klaus said on TV Prima that Russian President Vladimir Putin was behaving cautiously and soberly and not reacting to each provocation, adding that this was fortunate. Mr. Perebinyits asked whether Hitler too had been cautious and sober. The Ukrainian ambassador's comments received support from Czech MEP Jaromír Štětina and former Top 09 leader Miroslav Kalousek. A Czech pensioner called Jaromír Balda has confessed to cutting down trees that landed on railroad tracks, causing two train accidents in 2017. Mr. Balda, who is 71, told the Prague Municipal Court on Monday that he had left leaflets at the scene bearing fake jihadist slogans in order to discredit migrants who he referred to as a horror. The pensioner said that he has recovered his wits since being in jail for nearly a year and that he had not intended to hurt anyone. The case is being prosecuted as a terrorist attack and the perpetrator faces up to 15 years in prison if found guilty. Last year, over 570,000 Czech consumers changed their electricity supplier, a record number, the Czech electricity and gas market operator OTE reported on Monday. The figure was 60% higher than in 2017, and the numbers of Czechs switching to a different gas supplier also saw a year-on-year increase of 15.8%. Analysts told the Czech news agency that the main reason behind the trend has been the market increase in wholesale energy prices, which are affecting the total consumer price. And now to the weather. Tuesday is set to be cloudy, with temperatures just above zero across the country. Moravia and Silesia will see a mix of rain and snow, while in Bohemia it is expected to rain. Meteorologists expect countrywide snowing on Wednesday. I'm Tom McEncrow, and that is the end of the news. Hello and welcome to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech Radio. Coming up in today's programme, Prague City Hall is looking to turn the former hospital where Jan Palach died into a museum of totalitarianism. The number of Czech state attorneys who are ex-members of the pre-1989 Communist Party is set to lie at 1/6. And later historian Paulina Bren offers fresh perspectives on the normalisation period that followed the Soviet-led invasion of Czechoslovakia. All that coming up, so please stay with us. Fifty years ago this January, Jan Palach doused himself in petrol and set himself alight on Wenceslas Square to protest the Soviet occupation of Czechoslovakia. Prague City Hall is now looking to buy the former hospital where he died, slated to become a luxury hotel, and turn it into a museum of totalitarianism, Brian Kennedy reports.
In death, Jan Palach, a 20-year-old Charles University student, would become known as the conscience of the nation. Some 200,000 people attended his funeral to both honour his courage and voice their own contempt for the new hardline pro-Moscow regime.
I was one of those who did the first care, who cleaned the burnt areas. Of course, I shall never forget it, nor the days that followed. We were all very unhappy, not only over his fate, but the fate of the nation, because he did it for the nation.
The late Yaroslava Moserova, a doctor who became an ambassador after the Velvet Revolution there, speaking to Radio Prague in 2003 about Jan Palach's legacy. She was on duty at the Legerova Hospital, specializing in burns and plastic surgery, where he died in agony.
That he kept repeating, please tell everyone why I did it, please tell everyone. The reason why he did it was quite clear. It was not so much in opposition to the Soviet occupation, but the demoralization which was setting in. The people who were not only giving up, but giving in.
The communists tried to erase any traces of Jan Palach from public spaces. In 1973, for example, fearful his grave was becoming a shrine, they ordered the secret police to destroy it. Now, Prague City Hall is looking to save what it can of those traces from capitalism, if you will. What's more, Jan Palach is not the only Czech martyr to have died there. So too did Josef Tofar, a parish priest savagely beaten and tortured by the secret police into confessing to having staged the so-called Cichost miracle. Prague City Councillor Petr Zeman, founder of a wider initiative to save dilapidated buildings and convert them into public spaces, has been instrumental in pushing the city to buy the site. Standing outside the building, he laments, above the roar of traffic, plans to convert it into a luxury hotel.
It should be something other than a hotel, not necessarily housing only a museum of totalitarianism, but at least the operating theatre or rooms where Palach and Josef Tofar died should be preserved. I'd love to see it becoming something like a creative cultural centre.
A makeshift and unofficial memorial to the two men in the form of a stark black and white portrait has adorned the Legerva Street building since 2014, but district authorities say the location, where traffic is especially heavy, makes it inappropriate for a museum. And Prague's mayor has said that the city may abandon plans to buy the building if the sale price proves excessive.
And that was Brian Kennedy with that report. Now, Czech Radio's Iroslas news website reported on Monday that 1/6 of the Czech Republic's state attorneys are ex-members of the pre-1989 Communist Party. But defenders say it is unfair to judge them, as some prosecutors were blackmailed into getting a party card. Ian Willoughby has more.
Some 204 of the 1,252 current state attorneys in the Czech Republic were members of the Communist Party of Czechoslovakia prior to 1989. A study by Iroslas has found that represents around 16% of the total number. This figure is higher than among judges, 13% of whom carried party cards prior to the fall of communism almost 30 years ago. At the High State Attorney's Office in Prague, a full 30% of prosecutors are ex-communists. The Prague High State Attorney, Lenka Bradáčová, told Czech Radio there were historical reasons for her office's composition. She said the situation was legally recognised and couldn't be changed. Among ex-communist prosecutors is Igor Stříž. Today, first Deputy Supreme State Attorney, he was a party member from 1987 to 1989, when he served as military prosecutor. A spokesperson for the Supreme State Attorney's Office, Petr Mali, defended Mr. Stříž.
It is important to look not only at his former membership of a political party, but also at his professional skills and moral quality. When it comes to Mr. Stříž, the Supreme State Attorney's Office doesn't have any doubts about either of those things.
Formally, at least, joining the party wasn't a prerequisite to becoming a prosecutor. However, some may have felt they had no alternative. A spokesperson for the Ministry of Justice, Vladimir Zhepka, says there were various reasons for becoming a Communist Party member.
It is not possible to generalize when it comes to evaluating prosecutors' membership of the Communist Party of Czechoslovakia. Some were pressurized, for instance, being blackmailed as to whether their children could study. Rank-and-file membership of the party on its own cannot be used to disparage the moral character of state attorneys.
However, this doesn't wash with blogger Tomáš Pecina. The self-styled judiciary activist argues that the Czech justice system is a Jurassic Park of communism, and this has effects.
There are well-known cases in which communist criminals evade trial for many years, and that definitely would not be possible if the judiciary had undergone reforms back in the 1990s and these people had been replaced by others capable of at least neutral judgment.
In any case, with each passing year, there are fewer former communist prosecutors and judges, as both are obliged to retire at the age of 70 at the latest.
And that was Ian Willoughby with that report. Incidentally, he is also here to give you a roundup of the latest sports news.
Tennis, and Czech star Karolina Plíšková has gotten her season off to the perfect start by lifting the women's title at the Brisbane International in Australia. The one-time world number one lost the first set in Sunday's final against Lesia Tsurenko, but eventually secured a 4-6, 7-5, 6-2 victory, with the Ukrainian twisting her ankle in the final set. Plíšková's second title in a row in Brisbane was the 12th title of the 26-year-old's career. That result has also seen her leapfrog compatriot Petra Kvitová, who exited the tournament in the second round, to 7th in the latest WTA rankings. The Czech-American pairing of Květa Peschková and Nicole Melichar won the doubles competition at the Brisbane International, beating Taiwanese sisters Ho Ching Chan and Latish Chan 6-1, 6-1 in Saturday's final. Peschková and Melichar, who was actually born in Brno, had previously overcome the Czech world number ones in women's doubles, Barbara Krejčíková and Kateřina Siniaková, in the semifinals in Brisbane. The former Czech men's number one, Tomáš Berdych, made a return to the court last week after being sidelined for 6 months with a back injury. He could hardly have asked for a better comeback after reaching the final at the Qatar Open, which was only his fourth ATP final since 2015. However, there was no fairy tale finish in Doha, as Berdych lost 4-6, 6-3, 3-6 to Roberto Bautista Agut in Saturday's final. And that's all the sports news for now.
And that was Ian Willoughby with the sport. Just a reminder that you are listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio, where it's now time for our main feature of the day. Last year, on the 50th anniversary, we at Radio Prague covered many aspects of the 1968 invasion of Czechoslovakia. But what was life like after the Soviet occupation began? The normalization period is the specialization of Czech-born historian Paulina Bren, and she is Ian Willoughby's guest in this edition of One on One.
In her book, The Greengrocer and His TV, The Culture of Communism After the 1968 Prague Spring, historian Paulina Bren offers fresh perspectives on various aspects of Czechoslovakia's normalization period. These include how the communists used TV serials to get their message across at a time when the nation, forced to accept the reimposition of relatively hardline rule, largely turned inward. She makes particular reference to TV writer Yaroslav Dietl, creator of some of the most popular shows of that era. But when we met in New York, Bren, who was born Pavlina Břeňová in Brno, first told me how her own family had escaped Czechoslovakia when she was an infant, at the very time normalization was beginning to take hold.
My parents left with me and my sister in September of 1969, just a few weeks before the borders closed. And of course, they needed an exit visa at that time. in an invitation letter, and my mother wrote to friends of hers, Zdenia Zabrowska, I believe, who's a poet, and she with her husband, they were in Paris, and they received the letter literally as they were closing the door on the apartment and heading to the train station to return to Prague. So Zdenia quickly penned a letter pretending she was some French person living in Paris. My mother received it. It was just for my father and her. So she quickly added, et les enfants, which was my sister and me. So that's how the exit visa happened. And then this was already a year after the invasion. So there was really, at that point, Czechoslovakia was very much cut off from the West. But the Hotel International in Brno still was getting Western newspapers. So my father went there, found the London Times, went through it, saw an ad for a computer programmer, which was quite a specialty then, wrote a letter to them, never heard back from them, but then decided we should just go there. So my mother was sick and stayed with us. He headed to London, showed up at this firm. They didn't know what he was doing there. He didn't have an interview, but they interviewed him and they gave him a job on the spot. And then my mother, my sister and I followed soon after. 3 weeks later, the borders closed. So it was two kids, two suitcases and $100 because they had to leave everything behind and pretend they were going on vacation.
Jumping forward quite a way, in your book, The Greengrocer on His Television, The Culture of Communism After the 1968 Prague Spring, you talk about being in Prague in the late 1980s and getting under the space where the Stalin statue had stood. How did you get in there? What did you find there?
Oh my, I was there in 1987, and I just graduated from Wesleyan University here in the US. We emigrated one more time, and I became obsessed with coming to Prague, and I couldn't find a way to do it, and finally decided to just come on a tourist visa. While I was waiting for the tourist visa, I was in London, and to stay in cheap accommodations, I stayed at the Catholic Czech Center Velehrad, where I had always gone every Saturday to learn how to say R. And I met an artist, Petr Petr, who had just escaped from Prague. So it was sort of bizarre. I was now heading to Prague, and he sort of introduced me to all of his artist friends. So I had a really interesting view of Prague. I was there for a month. And through one of these artist friends, who was a climber, a caver, I suppose they're called, he and another friend, they decided it would be really amusing to take me down under Stalin. Of course, it was completely illegal, but they had done it several times. So middle of the night, flashlights and so forth, and they knew how to get in there. It was quite scary. There was especially this moment where there was just a mound of thousands and thousands of shoes. And of course, that is reminiscent for anybody of the Holocaust. So I don't know what they were doing there, but that image has always stuck with me.
The central theme of your book is the normalization period in Czechoslovakia. I've always thought normalization was a very strange word. Who coined the word, or when did it enter usage?
It is a strange word. The first official enunciation of the term happened when Dubček and his cabinet were returned from house arrest in Moscow a week after the invasion. He went on the radio in Czechoslovakia and explained that they'd come to an agreement about the rapid normalization of the situation. And it became an official word for it. And Husák, after 1989, claimed, oh, he did not conceive of the idea of normalization. Everybody did, because what else could one do with thousands and thousands of Soviet troops now occupying Czechoslovakia? What I love, I think part of sort of the Czech penchant for the absurd made it also very appropriate, because what else to call the abnormality of normalization than normalizace?
In your book, there's one fact that I found completely eye-popping. I never heard this before, and that is about the screenings of Communist Party members after the beginning, I guess, of normalization, when something like 250,000 committee members screened 1.5 million members of the Communist Party. What was the purpose of that screening?
Yes, it's strange, actually, that it's not really, one doesn't read about that very much, but I think it was absolutely pivotal to normalization. Originally, the Soviets hoped to just simply put in a new regime straight after the invasion, but they saw that was impossible. And they let Dubček hang on till April of 1969. Husák took over, and then the purges started in the summer. And first, they were very much aimed at the really public celebrity figures of the Prague Spring. But then they went into these purges really were mandated every single workplace. And even if nobody was purged, everybody received a form which they had to answer. And they had to say if they agreed or disagreed with the invasion, among other things. And in a sense, it was a pledge of allegiance. So it turned everybody into signatories to normalization. I think that was a really important part of trying to understand sort of the context of collaboration, if one might call it, or or perhaps something milder after 1968.
For those who don't get the reference, who is the greengrocer of your title?
Oh, the greengrocer is, of course, Václav Havel's greengrocer. And I sort of posit his idea of the everyday man in his wonderful essay about the greengrocer with sort of the everyday man that the television writer Yaroslav Dietl created in his television serials. And in a way, unfortunately, Yaroslav Dietl's everyday man was a little closer to the truth than sort of the wished-for greengrocer. I mean, Havel describes the greengrocer in terms of this very wide, odd spectrum of collaboration that normalization sort of demanded. But he hopes for the greengrocer to sort of take a stand that I think was very more complex than sometimes Havel realized.
Were the only two choices to essentially accept normalization and accept warm party rule or to become a dissident?
No, I don't think so. And I think that was part of the problem. That was why ultimately Charter 77 and Havel and other dissidents had such a resonance here in the West. But my book also deals with the question of why did they have so little resonance within Czechoslovakia among ordinary citizens. Part of that problem, I think, is precisely that it was set up in a very sort of binary opposition. Whereas the 70s and 80s normalization, or late communism as I refer to it, was very much about the gray areas. And indeed, in the mid-1980s, there was a big raucous within Charter 77 itself, where all these younger signatories who were not Prague-based were writing to the Prague headquarters and saying, we don't have a relationship to you. We can't relate to you. You don't relate to us. You don't actually care about how we think. And we have sort of united forces, not with other charter signatories, but actually with younger people who have different interests, different passions, different sort of ideas that they're pursuing. And it's these people that now are speaking to what an opposition will be.
There's also, I think, a sense that the kind of carrot of normalization was consumerism, that people received more products. But how does that square with the general image of communism as being a period of scarcity, of queues and lack?
I have to say I don't like that whole carrot metaphor that's always used. I think in terms of becoming a consumer, if you have even less to consume, I think that, in fact, forms you as a consumer even more. Because whether you're on the hunt for something as vital as toilet paper or something as desirable as 1980s VCRs and calculators, it changes your everyday practices, it changes your outlook and so forth. And I think in many ways, because of this emphasis on consumerism or consumption, because there wasn't that much, I mean, Czechoslovakia was still better off than other East Bloc countries, but nevertheless, because of that, everything was framed in terms of consumption. So when the Velvet Revolution happened, the idea of joining the West, of becoming European again, of entering that capitalist realm, was framed in terms of consumption, and that led to a lot of disappointments.
You also speak in your book about the role played by television in normalization. In a nutshell, what was that role?
In 1968, during the Prague Spring, radio still had, I would say, the most prominent role. But this was the moment when television began to shine. So when the invasion happened and the purge began, of course, the key targets were the media. Even as they were purging these media centers, they were also trying to figure out how they could use them. They realized it was necessary. And they sort of stumbled upon this realization that everybody, and they, of course, were doing surveys left and right. They're reading letters from citizens. But they realized that everybody, statistically, everybody was switching off the news. So they ended up sort of inserting the information they wanted to get across into the entertainment production instead. And television serials were particularly potent for this, in large part because Yaroslav Dietl, this famous Czech television writer, who in fact was very much for the Prague Spring, and they had to sort of bring him back, he had to purge himself a little bit, and then they brought him back. But Yaroslav Dietl had been fascinated already back in the 50s and the 60s with the genre of the television serial, and he had sort of convinced Czechoslovak television to let him write these, and they were very popular, so this was a perfect vehicle. He was a skilled writer, and he made the decision to write these television serials, and the regime was able to really use them as a way to have discussions in a seemingly non-political way, to have discussions about key issues, to show that they were solving problems. We're solving problems with housing, with single mothers, with a broken down healthcare system. All of these could sort of be sorted through seeing the images of these good, kind, constructive communists who understood the errors of ways and were able to change things and get Czechoslovakia back on the right path.
One thing also you refer to in your book is the returnees, people who left after 68 and then came back and perhaps then appeared on TV explaining where they'd gone wrong.
Right, exactly. Again, the numbers weren't huge, but certainly the call to emigres, to people like my parents who had fled, there were cycles of that, and they were promised pardons, and people did return, because it's very hard. I mean, it's very hard to show up in a foreign country without the language, without the contacts, friends, family, money, cultural knowledge. So understandably, it could be enticing to return with a pardon. And of course, in return for that, they were often met right on the tarmac. They were interviewed in order to say, of course, what was wrong with their experience in the West. And that sort of narrative was able to be woven into the narrative of the socialist good life, which, going back to the consumerist question, the recognition that, well, yes, we can't offer all the consumer goods that the West has, but we can offer other things, a socialist good life. That means, you know, we're not going to monitor you that much that you work that hard at work. We won't really check in on the 9 to 5. You'll have lots of time for hobbies, friends, social life, and so forth. That is what we can offer.
Is it possible to speak generally about how normalization is perceived today by Czechs?
I'm not sure I could actually speak to that, but I have to say it's shocking. I'm sure you've read sort of those newspaper articles as well about the interviews on the streets and asking people who was Husák, who was Dubček, what happened in 1968. And it's just shocking. Nobody knows. So to talk about sort of how the Czechs now interpret or think about normalization, I think that really the question is, how do many Czechs even interpret the past? Are they cognizant of the fact that there was a very long period of communism which had very different variations, 1950s versus 1960s versus 70s and 80s of normalization? That's sort of the question of forgetting.
Also, I guess, even though normalization was more recent, it was also less dramatic than many of the moments in the communist era.
Absolutely. I mean, there's sort of, you know, the phrase of banality of evil. I would say normalization, it's so incredibly banal in many ways. But at the same time, that's why it's so instructive. I think when we look at periods of extreme authoritarianism, let's just to stay with communism, to look at Stalinism, then it's easier to sort of take a stand, or at least to imagine oneself as not being a Stalinist, right? Normalization, I think, is far more instructive. It's about a more benign form of authoritarianism, of political ideologies, and the way that people can and do quite easily coexist with those kind of regimes. I think that's the question. So in a sense, I think it's the memory of that which is important.
And I guess from everything you're saying, you don't feel that we're in a position to, in any sense, judge people for, in quotation marks, collaborating with the system in that period.
Absolutely. There was a spectrum, a very large spectrum of collaboration during normalization. And in order to sort of just exist and function, you had to be somewhere on that spectrum. Also, if you were in Prague, it was much easier to protest. If you were in Prague and you were relatively famous, your voice could be heard in the West, it was much easier to protest than, let's say, a school teacher in Zlín. And I think that's important to keep in mind as well.
That was Paulina Bren, who spoke to Ian Willoughby in New York late last year. Since The Greengrocer and His TV, the historian has written a book about New York's women-only Barbizon Hotel. It is due to be published by Simon & Schuster and has been optioned by HBO. If you have any comments about today's programme, then please send them to us. You can contact us by email at english@radio.cz or on Facebook and Twitter. We'll be glad to hear from you. But that's all now from me, Tom McCrow. Thank you very much for joining us, and goodbye.